Welcome back to Coast AM. We're going to have a couple guests for you throughout the night tonight as we talk about some incredible UFO cases. Mexico's Roswell, aliens in the forest, the Koyami incident as well. Noe Torres joins me in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Later, we will be followed by Ruben Uriarte. He will join us, then phone calls on Coast to Coast. Sit back and enjoy this ride. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Coast. Noe Torres, author, publisher, UFO investigator, MUFON member in Texas. Noe holds a bachelor's in English and master's in library science from the University of Texas at Austin, one of our neat towns. He has been a UFO researcher for a long, long time with Ruben Uriarte. He has written a number of books, including several that we will talk about tonight. Amazing stories. Noe, it was good seeing you in Del Rio, and welcome back to Coast.
Thank you, George. Everybody is still excited down here in Texas at your visit in Del Rio. I've been getting nothing but positive feedback and continue to do so. So we were so happy to see you down here. You had a unique connection with the audience. Every single audience member was just soaking it all in. So it was a fantastic time, and thank you for having us on tonight.
What did they think of me singing, Noe?
I got some interesting comments about that. That was unexpected, but everything was positive, and we really enjoyed it. You know, I had to step out for a minute, but I saw the video afterward, and I thought you did a masterful job, actually.
We had fun. We had fun doing that. We look forward to coming next year, too. It was a great event. I want to go back and talk about some of the things that you've been doing with Ruben. And, you know, you've been on the program with us before, and we're definitely going to get into your latest work, the Koyami incident. But tell me a little bit about your interest, Noe, in UFOs. How did you get involved with all this? I mean, you got a degree in English, your master's in library science. How did you end up being a UFO investigator?
Well, it's happened to me on a very personal level because when I was a child, there was a very strange story that my mom told me on numerous occasions. It wasn't really a story as much as, you know, I would sit with her and she would just be thinking things through in her mind about an incident that happened to her in the 1940s here in South Texas. And she'd be asking herself questions, and then she'd ask me what I thought might have happened. And it was a really strange incident that, by the way, Brad Steiger included my mom's story in his book last year, Real Encounters, Different Dimensions, and Otherworldly Beings.
Ah, okay.
Brad, a friend of mine, was really, really interested in having me tell the story. It was a dark night here in South Texas, and my mom went behind the house because she heard a loud commotion. Everybody, the family was asleep in the house. She went out the back door, and it was a forested area where we lived at the time. It was, trees clustered close together. And all of a sudden, there was a bright light all around her, and the family dog was just went crazy and started jumping up in the air, snapping its jaws. And the interesting thing, George, was that try as she might, she told me later, she could not, it was almost as if her neck muscles were frozen, and she could not make herself look up above her head at where this whirring machinery-type sound was emanating from up above her head, and there was light illuminating all around her. And so that went on for a certain period of time, and she was basically, she got down on her knees and was just hoping for a way out of the situation with this terrific noise above her, the dog barking wildly, jumping up in the air. And then suddenly, the thing that struck her most of all, and I remember vividly her telling me on several occasions, that the whole episode ended as if somebody had turned off a light switch. She said, suddenly there was no sound at all. The light blinked off, and the dog immediately stopped barking. So, and then there was just the stillness of the nighttime, because this was in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So every time she'd tell me this story, it terrified me, and it made me wonder what sort of forces. At that time, I was 8 or 9 years old when she first started telling me this, and I was wondering what kind of strange, dark forces existed out there. We lived in a rather isolated, very isolated rural area here in South Texas along the border with Mexico. And at that time in the, when I was growing up, of course, I hadn't been born yet when this incident happened, but when I came along later, it was still a very agricultural area, very dark at night. And the closest neighbor was quite a number of miles away from us. So it was at that time, George, that I began basically devouring every single book I could get my hands on about UFOs and the paranormal. And so we had a large section of those types of books in my school library, surprisingly.
That is surprising.
But really, when I think about it, this area of the state of Texas, right along the border with northern Mexico, has always been a really concentrated area for folklore and mysterious tales. I remember hearing a lot of people tell me about little people who would appear suddenly in their bedrooms at night.
Mm-hmm. Or peering through their windows and things like that.
Peering through their windows, right. And it's funny because I was recently looking through some of the old Project Blue Book files. And there was a case reported here in Harlingen, Texas, which is about just about 30 miles from where I grew up, where a gentleman associated with a UFO sighting had these 4-foot-tall little guys suddenly appear in his bedroom. It's classified as an unknown by Project Blue Book. But these sorts of stories, and once I had time to look at all the case files that have happened throughout the United States and so forth and in the books that I read, that's when I really, really became interested in the subject. And eventually I began thinking about writing my own books. I connected with Ruben and we've done actually now 6 books together about famous UFO cases that have happened in Texas, the Southwest, and in northern Mexico. So it's an area of a lot of it's an area of enduring mystery and a lot of UFO connections here. People are kind of surprised when we tell them that and we tell them some of these stories, but we don't know exactly why. But it's always been a very an area where these sorts of stories do seem to proliferate.
Yeah, that area is very rich with these kinds of stories. And for a long time, you would think maybe these are just legends or myths, but they're not.
In every legend and myth, I'm convinced, George, there's an element to it that is actually real. I mean, something happened to somebody. And then over time, the story might change or deviate, but at its core, a lot of our folk tales and legends, I think, spring from real events, and especially in the context of here in South Texas. The example that I gave earlier, the little people, well, there's a connection there because UFO entities are always described as being about 3 or 4 foot tall, and so that goes right into that story as well, but you're exactly right. It's an element of mystery and it's sometimes people sometimes think that it's just folklore or superstition, mm-hmm. but it certainly does seem to have a lot of reality to it.
Noe, when you hear skeptics simply say, look, this is a vast universe. There's that possibility there's life out there, but they're not coming here. They've not come here. How do you feel about that?
Well, it's making a lot of assumptions, and it's presuming a lot about ourselves and our place in the universe, because we are not able to travel faster than light distances, because we have not discovered the secrets for the secret of moving between dimensions. We don't know, we have not discovered all the aspects of how the universe functions. And so the way I see statements like that is that I view them in the context of we are trying to put ourselves and our level of knowledge and scientific understanding above everybody else in the whole universe. So with me, it doesn't carry much weight because, you know, we see discoveries being made even by our own science very, very regularly that totally eliminate or override what we have thought in the past. The most recent example that I can just off the top of my head cite is all the number of potentially Earth-like planets now that have been discovered by our deep space probes in the last few years. Those numbers keep rising almost on a daily basis. So obviously our view of the universe keeps changing as we discover more and more of this truth. So for people to say that it's not possible that we've ever been visited is just presuming that we hold knowledge that we don't really possess, and thinking that human beings have an extremely important or very high standing in terms of intelligence and scientific understanding, which I don't necessarily think we do. So, you know, that's how I view it, George. It's just kind of a series of false assumptions.
Why is this area between Mexico and the United States, why does that seem to be so prevalent with UFO cases? What's happening in that area?
Yeah, well, now, Ruben and I have studied, you know, that UFOs, visitors from the stars, something that is very prevalent in Mexican culture, in ancient culture, dating back to the civilizations of the Mayas, the Mayan Indians, and the Aztecs, and many of the ancient folk of Mexico had these stories and these beliefs about visitors coming from the stars, descending from the stars, and teaching them wisdom. And interestingly, you know, the Mayans and the Incas were some of the top-notch mathematicians and astronomers, certainly in the period of time in which they lived. So there is obviously some connection between the ancient Mexican cultures and astronomy and the stories of visitors coming to the earth. And so we think that that carries over based on our long time that we spent talking to folks in Mexico, our counterpart civilian UFO investigators in Mexico, and the meetings and conferences that we've attended down there as well. We feel that this connection it comes forward to our day, and it's still very, very much embedded in the Mexican culture. You know, a lot of times, George, as you travel around the United States, and Ruben and I speak frequently at UFO conferences, we, a lot of times, outside of the group that attends our events or that attend the event at which we are speaking, outside of those groups, we find, of course, a lot of skepticism and a lot of criticism about the topic of UFOs. But in Mexico, you don't find that as much. Among the common folks, among the common everyday people, there is a widespread understanding or belief that UFOs do really exist and that we have been visited and are being visited today. So that is a lot more prevalent, and people are much more accepting of that notion, we have found, in Mexico, and that carries over across the border here as well. One story that I always tell, George, whenever I speak frequently here in South Texas about my UFO books and the work that Ruben and I have done. And every time when I finish speaking, a line has formed of people who want to share with me, and I'm sure you've had the same experience yourself when you give presentations and when you appear in public, is that I have a long line of folks that wants to share with me their own unique UFO experiences.
Yeah, no, they do.
Had or somebody that they know have had. So it's don't really know why, but this is an area that, number one, the folks are more apt to believe and to accept what has happened to them rather than try to find some kind of alternate explanation.
You know, sometimes I try to tell them when they come up to me at our meet and greets, you've got 400 people in line and they want to tell you their UFO story, which is great.
Right.
But I try to tell them, hey, you got to call in on open lines one night and tell me, because if you've got 400 people in line and this person's telling you a 10-minute story, you're going to be there for 6 weeks.
That's correct.
And so we try to get the line moving, but they are all passionate about their stories, Noe.
Well, absolutely, and the stories are so credible. I mean, there are gentlemen. You had an audience full of veterans there in Del Rio.
We sure did, amazingly so.
It was just tremendous that you recognized those folks and you had them all stand and talk about
those who could stand.
Yeah,
I always qualify that because I was in Norfolk, Virginia once, and I was going to do that with a group of veterans, and I noticed in the front row there were several of them who did not have legs. They had been wounded in battle. And so whenever I want to recognize veterans, the first thing I always say is, if you can stand up, please, and that kind. And but people just love them, and there was somebody who was a veteran who started crying there, Noe. I don't know if you were there at that point.
Yes. Now, the reason I mention veterans is I always had one of the largest groups of folks that always stays behind after meetings to talk to me is veterans who have had an experience, while they were in the military services. And that, to me, is extremely interesting. I've had some of the most compelling and convincing stories told to me about UFO encounters during, you know, by multiple witnesses, by multiple military witnesses that these folks happened to be in the company of when they saw it. And but the interesting thing, as you mentioned a few moments ago, is that we need to document these stories.
We sure do. Well, you're doing a great job with Ruben documenting many of these.
Yeah. But the interesting thing, you know, and one of the, we're probably going to talk about more today, is the Del Rio UFO incident that Ruben and I have written a book in which Colonel Robert Willingham has attempted to tell his story way back to 1968. We found a publication from 1968 where he first started talking about having chased the UFO in his F-86, seen it crash near Del Rio, Texas. But the problem is that there are so many skeptics and so many people that are opposed to this truth coming out that they cause these folks a lot of ridicule and a lot of problems. So Colonel Willingham has experienced all that, and he's been ridiculed, and his story has been, said to be a fabrication and so forth. And a lot of the veterans will not come forward in public and make a document.
That's right. Hey, stay with us, Noe. We'll be back with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, if you didn't know it yet, we have a television program, internet-based, called Beyond Belief. And it is available for you to watch. And so many people are watching it. And they like it. As a matter of fact, go all the way back and watch my interview with David Wilcock. It is one of the highest rated shows there. Simply go to this website, sign up to watch it at beyondbelief.com. That's www.beyondbelief.com. Welcome back this hour. Noe Torres with us. Noe, if this Koyami incident, which is the basic, was that the second incident of the Mexico Roswell crash, or is that a different one?
No, it is actually what a lot of UFO researchers call Mexico's Roswell, because it happened right on the Rio Grande River near Presidio, Texas, and right over into just a little bit north of Ojinaga, which is the border town in Mexico that's directly across from Presidio.
Okay, I'm going to have you talk about it. Then the next hour when Ruben joins me, I'm going to have him pick up with this story. But based on what we know, based on your book, Mexico's Roswell, there was a mid-air collision back in 1974 between a little plane, almost like a Cessna,
right,
and a UFO. Pick up that story from there.
Yeah. The reason we did this new edition of the book is because so much more information has come forward, and since we did the original book called Mexico's Roswell in 2007,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot more that's come forward. But what happened that evening, that was in August of 1974, August 25th. So it gets very hot in the summer in Texas, as you know, and especially in West Texas. So it was the evening after a very, very hot day. We've looked at climactic conditions and storms in the area and stuff like that for what was going on. And what happened was that there was a small plane that had taken off from El Paso International Airport and was headed toward Mexico City. And we've talked to pilots who say that that is a customary route that's followed there in the area of Coyame, Mexico, which once again is this area just across the river from Presidio, Texas. It's in the western part of Texas in what a lot of folks refer to as the Big Bend, because the Rio Grande River makes this huge bend there that kind of gives Texas, West Texas, its distinctive shape. But anyway, so this small plane from El Paso is heading right along the river before it makes a large sweeping turn toward Mexico City, toward the south. And right there, just north of the town of the small Mexican village of Coyame, I think they had about 5,000 inhabitants at the time that this incident happened for that whole area. Suddenly there was this mid-air collision, which we found witnesses on the Texas side of the international boundary that saw this fireball in the sky.
How does this happen, Noe?
We don't know exactly. You know, the UFO had been picked up earlier in the evening off the coast of Corpus Christi, Texas. So we're talking about the Gulf Coast, and it had veered down to around Brownsville, Texas. It was doing all sorts of zigzag maneuvers, going over 2,000 miles per hour at an altitude of about 75,000 feet. And then it finally got down to the area of Brownsville, Texas, and it crossed over into Mexican territory. So it completely avoided coming over U.S. territory, and it crossed into northern Mexico, and that's when it went straight across Mexico, and suddenly, you know, somewhere over Coyame, Mexico, is where this collision with the small plane. Now that area, Ruben and I have been out there doing field work on this case and talking to the local ranchers and the townspeople in Coyame, and that area is characterized by high desert mountain peaks, some as high as 7,000
mm-hmm.
feet above sea level. So the folks we've talked to seem to feel that it was just the fact that the small plane may have come from around from behind one of these mountain peaks.
I just still think it's amazing that a craft with that kind of technology to come here, whether it popped out of a mothership or came here, you know, through wormholes or whatever, would collide with a small plane. That it just boggles my mind.
Well, it's what seems to have happened is that it seemed to have not detected the presence of the small plane for whatever reason, because it just plowed into it. Based on the information we've gathered, there was no sort of attempt at an evasive maneuver by either craft. Now, of course, the UFO was traveling at a tremendous rate of speed, although it had slowed from the previously estimated speed of 2,500 miles an hour. It was slowing down and descending. It had descended down to below 40,000 feet earlier in the evening, and then, it was lower than that, although we don't have an exact figure, when the collision occurred somewhere over Coyama, Mexico.
What happened to the pilot of the small craft?
Well, the thing is that the small plane was virtually obliterated.
So he got killed, I assume.
You know, we went out to that area. We found a large debris field of parts from an airplane of that vintage,
yeah,
of that year. And all the pieces were, we don't know for certain that this was the plane involved in the collision, but it was in more or less the right spot. And there seemed to be some evidence that it could have been, and it was all in small pieces. I mean, we picked up tiny little pieces of the instrument panel. We brought them back.
I assume they never found the pilot then, right?
I would say not.
All right. So it collides with this craft. What happens to the craft?
Well, that's where this story becomes incredibly interesting, is because there was a retrieval team from the U.S. We know these crash retrieval teams exist. And they pull members from all over the U.S. military and intelligence community and come together in a very short period of time at a certain location, and then they go out to make these retrievals. And, in fact, we've spoken to folks who claim that they were members of such a retrieval team. But in any event, a retrieval team was staged, brought together at Fort Bliss, which is one of the largest U.S. Army bases in North America. It happens to be in El Paso, Texas, which is very close to where this incident happened. And so this retrieval team was brought together, and they went in helicopters, in a helicopter squadron, down to where the crash happened. Now, what's interesting is we had never, until the past couple of years, we had never talked to anybody who had seen the helicopter convoy until we found Mrs. Johnny Chambers and her son, John, who, Mrs. Chambers is a longtime Texas educator, has received all kinds of awards from the state. She taught in a one-room schoolhouse in Rio Doce, which is just north of Presidio. And they were coming down the mountain in 1974 when they saw this fireball explosion in the sky. And then John Chambers, her son, who was 10 years old at the time, told us that a couple of days later, all of the small town there was abuzz because a team or a group of U.S. military helicopters had come buzzing over their town from Mexico, headed back into the U.S. And people thought that was extremely strange, because why would U.S. military aircraft be coming across from Mexico? And he had never put that together with any particular incident or any case, or certainly nothing UFO-related, until many years later, until a few years back when he found out about the work that Ruben and I were doing, and back when we were... the town of Presidio on the Texas side of the border contacted us to put together a little conference, a little festival, mm-hmm, in commemoration of what happened in 1974. And so we were doing that, and that's when the Chambers came forward with their incredible story, which is included in our book, The Coyama Incident. And so that's basically it. We've got people, we've got a lot of folks that have come forward and told us very unusual stuff that happened in 1974 in that area of the state of Texas.
And it appears that both the Mexican and U.S. governments seem to cooperate with each other.
Yeah, that's right. We've spoken to a lot of UFO researchers, both in Mexico and the U.S., and especially during that period of time, there seems to have been a lot of collaboration on retrievals. And in fact, there were a number of retrievals of U.S. downed military hardware in northern Mexico in the 50s, 60s, and even early 70s. We had missiles that went astray, as you know.
Yeah.
Dating way back to when the paperclip scientists were stationed in El Paso at Fort Bliss, and were, you know, they were shooting off rockets that more off, a lot of times would go into northern Mexico and crash. One of them crashed into a cemetery in Ciudad Juarez across the bridge from El Paso and made a huge crater. Well, the Mexican government didn't take too kindly to having big craters made by U.S. crashed missiles, you know, that went astray. But at the higher levels of government, there was a lot of collaboration, and the U.S., in most cases, was allowed, with very few difficulties, was allowed to go in and retrieve their fallen hardware. And I'm sure that there were lines of communication that were kept open on these sorts of incidents, and it's very likely that if a UFO crash had occurred, that a cover story was put out that it was a downed U.S., you know, experimental aircraft or missile. So that would have covered their basis on that.
So what does your gut tell you about this specific case, Noe?
Well, the interesting thing about it is, like in a lot of UFO cases, unfortunately, you've got bits and pieces of a huge mosaic, and then there are forces at work to keep a lot of it away from the public, unfortunately. So what we have is what you would call a lot of circumstantial evidence, and we have eyewitness reports of people who saw something. And everything seems to point to something really strange happening in August 1974 in this particular area of Texas in northern Mexico. And so Ruben and I are proposing that what happened is that a strange craft, not from Earth, crashed there, and that it was recovered and brought back to the U.S. by this retrieval team. And we feel that it's a subject that requires more investigation and more research, and so that's why we're putting this out there. And interestingly enough, we've had all kinds of bits and pieces come forward since the book in 2007, and which we've included in our new book. There was this mysterious posting of new information on Wikipedia a couple of years ago. Try as we might, we were never able to track down the source. The person was very elusive, and we could never determine who his exact identity. However, he was a person who posted articles on many different subjects on Wikipedia, so he wasn't somebody who just suddenly appeared and posted this. He had been posting for years. In his postings, he gave details and information that Ruben and I, who had been working on the case for nearly 10 years, had never heard about George. He named the names of U.S. soldiers who died, who participated in the retrieval, and the Mexican soldiers who died, four of the Mexican soldiers who died in the in attempting to retrieve the UFO before the U.S. retrieval team got there. So those names were put on Wikipedia, as in addition to a lot of other details that we had never heard of. So we think that, you know, we were really trying to get information as to who this poster was, who this person who posted this information was, but we were never able to, as I say. And then other bits and pieces have come forward, such as the Chambers story, having seen this huge explosion in the sky just north of Presidio. That was another story that came forward. And then Ruben has a really eerie story that was told to him by a Los Angeles police officer whose family came from Coyame, Mexico.
Oh, really? Should I wait to ask him that?
Right.
Okay.
He'll bring that forward to you, because it's amazing. It happened in 1974. We estimate it happened right after the UFO crash, that he came face to face with something that was totally unearthly. So, Ruben will fill you in on that one. And so we've got a lot of information that has come forward. For example, we're just working with our liaison, with our colleagues in Mexico, UFO researchers in Mexico. We found out that in 1974, just a couple of weeks after this incident supposedly happened, the Mexican army commander for that whole zone that includes Coyame and Ojinaga was suddenly replaced. He had been on the job for years. And 3 weeks after the date of the Coyame incident, he was suddenly replaced. And then that same month, August 1974, 5 days after the Coyame incident, the President of the United States at the time, Gerald Ford, suddenly requested a meeting with Mexican President Luis Echeverria. Now, I've looked into the archival materials for President Ford's term of office, and I cannot find any specific reason why the meeting was called. So the meeting was, Gerald Ford's team tried to schedule a meeting right away after August 1974, but the meeting wasn't actually held until October, which was still within 2 months after the Coyama incident.
How would you rate this case, Noe, to the actual Roswell case?
Well, we'd like to see, of course, a lot more firsthand witnesses come forward. Now, with Roswell, you have over 100 folks that were involved with the airbase, with the operations of the airbase, as well as civilians in town who saw something significant. And so we don't have that in the Mexico's Roswell case. We have a lot of little bits and pieces that seem to indicate something happened there. So it's an intriguing and interesting story, and it's got a lot of, interesting aspects to it. The military team from Mexico went out first, and all the soldiers died from being exposed to something at the crash site. And then the U.S. came in wearing biohazard gear and retrieved the UFO and brought it back to the U.S. It's a fascinating story, but we don't have the level of witness testimony that we like yet. We're still collecting information. You know, it took about 30 to 40 years for the details of the Roswell incident to come forward, because it happened in 47 and the first book published about it was in 1980, which Stanton Friedman did the research for. So it takes time, I think, for these UFO cases to start. 1974 is actually fairly recent.
Well, that's not far away considering some of these other episodes, Noe. Noe, we're going to get Ruben on, and you sit back and listen in, okay?
I sure will. Thanks.
Ruben Uriarte will be our next guest. Their websites, by the way, are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, as everybody's are, roswellbooks.com. Up next, Ruben Uriarte joins us. We'll talk more about the Coyame incident, Mexico's Roswell, next on Coast to Coast AM.